So we've done a lot of classes on working with judgmental mind, maybe transforming judgmental mind a little bit, maybe, or at least having more ease around it, not being judgmental of judgmental mind, which is very easy to do. My God, I can't believe I'm so judgmental. Have you ever had that thought? I can't believe I'm so judgmental of being judgmental of being judgmental. It just never stops. So, of course, it does stop with kindness and mindfulness. And that's those are the two main practices we use in the insight or Vipassana world. And we've actually done a lot of different practices. And part of the practice has been getting just that our thoughts are approximations of reality, and our thoughts at best can indicate reality, but they can never be reality because our thoughts symbolize reality. Our thoughts are the map and not the territory. So as the Zen tradition uses the analogy of our thoughts are like a finger pointing at the moon. The finger can't be the moon. The moon is the moon. Our thoughts can't capture it, but we can indicate it. We can point towards it, and we can have thoughts that really don't point towards it at all. Look, there's the moon, and we're just not pointing at anything like the moon. So the basic summary of all this is that our thoughts can never be true, but they can be useful. And so our judgments can never be true. And maybe they can be useful. Usually our discriminations can be useful. I'm not sure I've ever found a judgmental thought to be useful. Maybe. But it certainly has a cost, even if it is useful. So that's been part of this series. We've done loving kindness practice for the last three classes. And I kind of thought that we would do tonight's class towards the end of the series. So this might be the last class in the series unless people clamor for more. But we've had about eight or nine classes, and maybe you're sick of this topic by now. I don't know. But so the topic tonight is how to deal with other people being judgmental of us, being critical of us. So the hope is that as we've worked with judging mind, we've softened up enough on the inside that we can really start to work with, oh, what's going on when someone is throwing it at us? And I just want to read a poem about how when we do soften up and become kinder to ourselves, it's really nice. So this is called The Healing Time by Persia Gertler. Finally, on my way to yes, I bump into all the places where I said no to my life, all the untended wounds, the red and purple scars, those hieroglyphs of pain carved into my skin, my bones, those coded messages that sent me down the wrong street again and again, where I find them, the old wounds, the old misdirections, and I lift them one by one, close to my heart, and I say, holy, holy, holy. Now, we know if we could lift all our old wounds and actually see them as blessed, as holy, we know our spiritual a current of spirituality is running very deep inside of us. We can see all of our flaws and our foibles and our warts and our shortcomings and our yelling at the kids, our being late for work, our snapping at our partner. We could actually hold it all as holy. That would be pretty darn amazing. There's lots of different ways to come at that, and I've done that in other classes, so we're not going to really go there. But But as our path deepens, as we become more tender in our heart and more open in our heart, we really start to get that even our wounds and our flaws are just as blessed as, you know, a beautiful sunset or the tide coming in at the beach. It's all holy, even the suffering. So in a way, I think to really be able to be okay with people criticizing us and getting socially embarrassed, we do need this deep current of spirituality. We need a deep and broad and loving perspective to sort of weather the slings and arrows. And in this group, maybe 3 years ago or something, it was a class on working with fear. I just did a poll on not what's your worst fear, but what's your most common fear. And so everyone wrote things down in their slips of paper. I think only one of them was fear of death. There was a couple of fear of physical discomfort, and 17 or 16 out of the 22 were on some fear of social rejection, embarrassment, criticism, some fear in the social arena. So that's, you know, that's representative of our group. I don't know if it's representative of the world at large. I would think so, but it's definitely representative of us. This is a really big deal and really common. I was sort of surprised by that. I wasn't sure what people were going to say. This was a class on fear. It wasn't really one on embarrassment or shame or hurt feelings. But that's pretty much what we were all saying. So my sense is that one reason that this is so big for us, we're so afraid of criticism because we just can't take it anymore. We're already doing it so much. On the inside, we come pre-disapproved. There's some joke about the economy so bad, you know, you get a credit card offer in the mail, you've been disapproved. That's like the offer. You've already been pre-disapproved. And often, I think, for a lot of us, it links up. If someone criticizes something we do, an action, we very quickly make it global. And we link it up to maybe an already existing sense of deficiency or unworthiness or basic badness. And so it actually is very hard to just have a criticism be about a limited thing, an action, which is just a part of us and it's specific in time. We tend to globalize it, and it lands on our woundedness. And so then it's very difficult to hear criticism. There's a way in which, especially if we're criticized in front of other people, it's like we're unmasked, we're exposed. But really what we're exposed to often is our own sense of unworthiness. That's the embarrassment that we feel. So from this perspective, the degree to which someone hurts your feelings is the degree to which some part of you agrees with them. So if someone criticizes you for something that you're not working on, that you're not doubtful about yourself, you know, that you don't care very much about, wow, you're a really slow runner or something, and you could care less about that. You're not working on that in yourself. It just doesn't matter to you. But when we say, you know, it hits close to the bone, what the bone is probably hitting close to is our own inner doubt and inner critique of ourselves. So, like Eleanor Roosevelt said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent. someone calls you a slow runner, you're like, whatever, doesn't matter to me. But someone says the zinger, the one that is really something you're doubtful about, and you really feel inferior. That's your consent. That's some part of you already in agreement. And what we often do, because social embarrassment is, you know, painful, and see if you feel this is true for you, is we beat people to the punch so that we make sure that we live within the boxes of, you know, we're going to be within these boundaries so that we don't get criticized. And in a way, that's much worse. It's much better if it comes from outside, because then it's living out there and we're not carrying it around. If we are pre-disapproving of ourselves all the time so that we don't get that public embarrassment, we're sitting with our private criticism a lot. We're carrying it around with us a lot. So in some ways, working with the inner critic, one way that we can expand our boundaries is to not be quite so scared of being publicly critiqued. Because if we can relax more and not be so hard on ourselves and let it come more from the outside, we're happier because we're not carrying it so much. But we have to be willing then to be able to be embarrassed, to be at times what feels like unmasked or exposed. And we can do it with our practice. So the last part of class will really be about how our practice can help us with feelings of shame and embarrassment, and the perception that you're rejected. So when we do this a lot, when we just keep being hard on ourselves so that we can avoid any kind of external criticism, the most extreme form of this, of course, is perfectionism, where we're just going around, God forbid I should make a mistake because I'm going to get slammed. And there's only one problem with perfectionism, is that it's a complete oxymoron, because perfectionism itself is a fatal flaw, because we can't be happy trying to be perfect. It's like Civil War or jumbo shrimp or military intelligence, right? It's oxymoronic. We cannot perfectionize our way to happiness. It can't happen, because perfectionism itself is the problem. It's hard to be happy. So we're all flawed, aren't we? Every Dharma teacher I know is. Every person I've ever met is. We are all deeply flawed. And I don't think we're ever going to get out of it. It's just it's a huge part of our humanity. We're always going to be flawed in some way. We might become perfectly wise, you know, by age 40 or something, and then our body starts falling apart, and then our mood starts falling apart, and if we're a woman, we go into menopause, and then our mood really falls apart, and I don't know what the guy equivalent is. We just become sort of like grumpy and, you know, tired. right? So there's just no such thing as getting perfect. I just want to read a little bit of, this is from Tenisiro Biko in Tricycle Magazine. He writes that several years ago, a sociologist studied students in a neurosurgery program to see what qualities separated those who succeeded from those who failed. He ultimately found that two questions in his interviews pointed to the crucial difference. He would ask students, "Do you ever make mistakes? If so, what is the worst mistake you've ever made?" Those who failed the program would inevitably answer that they rarely made mistakes, or else would blame their mistakes on factors beyond their control. Those who succeeded in the program not only admitted to many mistakes, but also volunteered information on what they would do to not repeat those mistakes in the future. So in other words, the people who succeeded failed and learned from it, and went forward. So basically, the road to success is paved with failure. Right?
Hooray.
Yay! Yeah. Exactly. Thank God, right? Of course, the road to failure is paved with failure, too. So maybe the road to failure is paved with success or denying our failures. But basically, we don't get out of this human condition of being flawed. Our only way to succeed is to be really real and honest and forgiving about it and learn from it and not use it as an excuse to beat ourselves up. That's just hallucinatory to beat ourselves up for our flaws. So here's another poem about how flawed we all are. It's called You Know What You Are, Buddy, by Red Hawk, who's going to be in Europa, I think on the 22nd of June. As I am pulling into the gas station, a woman roars out from behind a pump and cuts right in front of me. I slam on the brakes, lay on my horn, and she stops just long enough to lean out her window and scream at me, You know what you are, buddy. Yeah, I do. I am a sorry little loser who doesn't know his ass from a gas pump. I am an arrogant, educated screed who will show you everything I know for a dollar. I am a scared, tense, lonely humbug willing to sell myself to the first woman who shows me a grain of kindness. I am a dazed and hopeless idiot wondering how I got here and what I am going to do next. I am a third-rate poet, a broken and ruined lover of God, a spiritual derelict hooked on Dharma, a bum for truth, a pimp for the teachings of masters, but what I want to know is, how could she tell? That's some acceptance, right? Okay, so we're kind of at the halfway time, so we'll take a break shortly, but I just want to open it up and see if there's comments, sharings, questions. No pressure. Either you completely agree with everything I said, or you're bored.
too embarrassed.
Yay, thank you.
So, it's a short question. I'm walking all over the back here with it. I wanted some clarification on this notion that it's better or it's perhaps more better for you to get that rejection externally rather than internally, because it's out there. Because to me, it would seem like then you just have two types of rejection. It seems like your internal one's not going to go away, really, because you're also getting validated externally. So I was curious, because you made that comment that you said at the end of this, you'll give us some techniques on how to deal with that. I was like,
yes.
That doesn't seem to make sense at all.
I'm thinking of the movie Harold and Maude or something where, you know, they just were in their own joy. And if you're filled up with your own joy and your own sense of love for what you're doing and who you are and your friends, you don't care what people think about you so much. The caring of what people think about us makes us very weak and susceptible to really taking in other people's criticism. If we're carrying that inner critic around in us all the time, we're not living out of our joy and our zest and our passion. We're always second-guessing ourselves and very unhappy because of it. So happiness is our best revenge, and we can stay happy simply by letting the criticism come from the outside more so that we're not so self-conscious. And so the last part of class will be very much about how we can do that. But it actually really does mean being willing and able to sit with the horror of social embarrassment, social rejection, and feel. I mean, you know, embarrassment for me is, and some of you probably have a similar experience, it's very hot in the face, and so it's being in that heat, in that raw energy of embarrassment. And the more mindful we are of our experience, the more accepting of it we are, and the less we believe the thoughts and the criticism that someone else have of us. They just don't land as deep when we're really mindful and loving. We need to be both things. And then the criticism can really just be out there, and we don't care so much. So stay tuned. There's two more parts of class. The second part of class will be how we can get that someone's critique of us is mostly about them. There may be information for us, and we need to take that in. But we can have it land not so deep by getting it, that people's judgments are really about them, and I'm going to unpack that more. So that's part of this. And the other part of it is what I just said, that our mindfulness practice helps us so that it isn't double, inner and outer. It's just outer. And we can learn from that, but that has nothing to do with our basic goodness as people. We make mistakes. We screw up. And we need to learn. Big deal. We're great. We're still fine. You know? And actually, this is really important. When you watch yourself make a mistake, a good person who just screwed up, as opposed to saying, what's wrong with me? We make some little mistake, right? Like, say you're spacing out and you run a stop sign or whatever, you just were spacing out, and a good person who wasn't quite, who needs to pay a little more attention, right? That's no big deal. So positive judgments of our personhood are very helpful. Negative judgments of our personhood are very unhelpful. So that's part of it too. So
if you get a ticket, sorry, I was just imagining. So yeah. if a cop pulls you over for going through the stop sign, you're less devastated by the experience if you come from a place of self-acceptance.
Definitely. So then you would say,
a
good person who ran a stop sign, poor guy's getting a ticket. Dang. You know, this is a real ding, not on my personhood, on my wallet. But it's nothing wrong with me. It's just like, that was unmindful, right? Ooh, I got to pay more attention.
What somebody else is thinking, because I think I and probably a lot of us do that a lot. So we've got this whole story going that they're not even thinking. So, use some wisdom on that one.
Well, mindfulness will show you this all the time, that we take our worst thoughts about ourselves and then we appoint a committee out there that is holding those same thoughts. And we are literally looking at ourselves when we look at their disapproval or their this or that. And my wife and I, my partner and I like to say partner. My partner and I, Lisa, we notice this all the time. We're both real extroverts. And so if someone is this, we would never assume someone was shy. We would assume they don't like us, because they're not talking to us the way we're talking to them. And so we're just projecting our own reality onto them. So we that knowledge is really important when people are judging us. When we watch ourselves simply taking our worst thoughts about us and injecting it into others, then we can have an insight when someone's judging us that that's actually what they're doing. So it's actually really about them. Now, this is not to disregard there might be information that's important when someone is giving us feedback. And if we want to be open and connected to the person, we don't want to be dismissive. But we can let that judgment go in much less deeply if we just say, wonder what's going on with them, as opposed to, wow, what's wrong with me?
I'm just thinking in situations like that, for me, I don't usually go, I don't get as far as saying, oh, I wonder what's wrong with them.
Not wrong with them, what's going on with them.
Well,
important clarification.
But it's just that heat of embarrassment.
Yes.
That's what just takes over.
Yes.
And
yes.
So can you talk about the skill of kind of coming off that and into...
Okay. This is where our mindfulness practice is a big inner and social adventure. It's really awesome when we can take our practice into a real life situation off the cushion and actually, in the middle of that heat and those prickles or that flushed experience, actually be like, wow, I am really activated. This would be a good time for me to be kind and soft and attentive with myself. Now, in the middle of an engagement, and it completely depends on the context, but with good friends and, you know, intimates, we might be able to say, okay, I'm going to be quiet for a little minute here. I'm just going to check in. In a work situation, I don't know. It's time for a bathroom break or, look at the sky. But we do need this sacred pause. And we need to know it's happening. And then we need to be willing to be aware of the experience, especially in our bodies. And I'll just say that much. Is there something you want to follow?
No, I like that idea of the sacred pause.
The sacred pause is everything in our social interactions. Mm-hmm. Some of you have heard this, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but for those who haven't, when we're in the grips of a strong emotion, neuroscience is now doing a lot of research on this, we are literally in brain sprain. The amygdala, which is this little gland in the midbrain, about that big, actually shunts our neuronal pathways away from the forebrain, which is our awareness centers as well as our seeing possibility centers, and we're limited to very, very simple thoughts. When we're really scared or really angry or really ashamed, we are literally in brain sprain. Our thoughts are not, remember I said our thoughts can indicate reality or not. In brain sprain, our thoughts don't. We can only think really simple thoughts. What's wrong with me? Or what a jerk? Or, whatever. I can't stand this. Whatever. So the sacred pause, if we can do it and spend some time with our emotion, the amygdala releases. And we literally can see new possibilities. Oh, that was a shy person, maybe. Or maybe they were having a bad day, as opposed to, my God, that person hates me, right? So that's sacred. So we'll work with this more towards the end of class, how to actually do this. So now let's talk about how to work with it when we do get criticized by someone else and we get some feedback that's hard for us. So just to be clear, anything, if a person says anything about your personhood, just throw it out the window because they don't know what they're talking about. Unless they've known you your entire life and have been with you through all of your ups and downs and your trials and tribulations and joys and triumphs and literally are living inside your heart, maybe then they're qualified to comment on your personhood. But otherwise, it has nothing to do with you.
Can you explain and be more okay? What you mean by personhood?
If someone says something to you like, I really don't feel like you heard me right there, right? So that's something specific. But if someone says to you, you are such a bad listener, right? That's just a big, global, general conclusion about you. You can say, so what's happening right now? I mean, that's just a way to even deflect that big... Basically, it's character assassination, right? So anytime someone's making those kind of comments to us, there's no reason to entertain that and feel bad because they don't know enough to know that. And I'm really just building on what we've already gone through in this class, that statements about personhood generally are very general and don't help. What if we need to give feedback, it needs to be specific in time, it needs to be about an action, and it needs to be about, is something working or not working? When we throw in good and bad, right and wrong, that creates all kinds of trouble. So when we hear that coming from someone else, we can sort of like ignore that part of it and actually do a reframe where we can focus specifically on the action that someone's having a problem with and some way in which that didn't work for them, as opposed to you're good or bad or right or wrong. So that's kind of what I'm referring to when I say that. So, and then if we go into some kind of what's wrong with me type of thinking, that is also not the point, right? Because that's actually linking up with what we've already talked about, which is some deeper sense of unworthiness about our personhood. That is also irrelevant to the context of the situation of two people trying to get along. That has nothing to do with it. Does that make sense too? If you feel yourself caving into what's wrong with me energy, that is not helpful to you or the person. It disconnects you from what they're trying to tell you, and it when we're in that kind of shame place, we are frozen and we are energetically basically sealed. We're hunched over, literally physically and mentally. When we're in that kind of place, we're collapsed around our unworthiness. And that is not any kind of interactive mode that's helpful. Yeah. Yes?
So the only thing, though, I just would like to add, is that that's actually what people say all the time, and that's what we think, what I think. I don't have a problem with somebody, they are, so whatever.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So we're aspiring to do something else.
Yes. So when we watch your language when you're talking about somebody or talking about yourself. Are you talking about action specific in time? And are you talking about it working or not working? Or are you making these global, big generalizations that you don't know to be true? So.
And Peter, what would it look like to have... I lost my train of thought. What would it look like to have a response to someone giving that kind of criticism towards you, if you're in a strong space within yourself,
yes,
and that's coming at you, and,
yes,
and you feel yourself being affected,
yes,
by that? What is a good response?
Well, again, okay, so the question is, if you feel yourself being affected by unskillful communication coming at you, and you notice that you're actually getting sucked into that, you start out by saying, well, if you're kind of strong, but then it sounded like you were saying, yeah, but then you kind of get...
Be affected, yeah.
So there's sort of two different questions. So... what do we do if we're getting sucked in when someone's being really unskillful with us? So we have to notice ourselves. So this is where the sacred pause is really important. We have to be aware. There's really three things most helpful to be aware of: sensation, thought, and image. So be aware of that in yourself. So you may even try it right now. See if you can remember the last time someone was actually quite either aggressive or unskillful to you, where it really sort of like flummoxed you in some way. So remember that, And if you would, notice right now, as you remember, what's the image in your mind? What are the thoughts in your mind? And what's the way your body might be expressing your mental state? Feel your body. Notice what sensations are obvious in your body. If in your thought and image, and this might be hard to recreate now, but if in your thought and image you're noticing yourself going into all kinds of negative self-talk, you know that you're kind of compromised. If you're blaming yourself or you're blaming the other, those are two important things to look for, because both are aggressive ways of communicating. Self-blame or blame of the other is basically a kind of aggression. So you want to look for that. You want to look for global personhood kind of what's wrong with me kind of thoughts and images. You want to look for a slumped over body posture. You know, you want to feel that. And then you know that something's going on that's more than just the situation. So this really goes back in a way in answer to your question, that's when a sacred pause might be helpful, if it's possible. But the thing to do, so that's with your own self, but the thing to do with someone else's their actual unskillful communication is to really listen for the things. Are they character assassinating you? If so, it's just not relevant. Character assassinating, are they being specific about actions or not? Are they telling you something specific? If they're not, then try to clarify. Try to say, well, now so... You know, try to have them get specific with you. And is the language you're hearing good and bad, right and wrong language? Or is it like, this just isn't working language? So that's really what we're talking about, is the difference between judgment and discrimination. So you would listen for that. Now, you can also go a step further. And this takes a lot of training, because obviously in the heat of a moment... a lot's happening, especially if someone's being aggressive. But we have to really not take this on. And when someone's being aggressive, that can be very hard, right? Like if someone's coming at us with some kind of force, it's really easy to take it deep. So we have to rehearse this a lot. We have to see all this. This is then really advanced. Can you actually guess or intuit or feel into what might be their feelings and needs underneath this very unskillful action? And if you can take a guess for that, and then don't respond to what they're directly saying it or the way they're directly saying it, respond to what you're guessing are the feelings and needs under it. And that's, in a way, the best you can do. And does anyone want to add something to that?
I'd like to say something that, it's fun to kind of practice with people further away from me, to close the practice of my brain of compassion for myself being attacked or the person who's attacking me. And so, like you're saying, if someone is saying really something joyful to me, and to not take it personally, of take that sacred moment and say, oh, they're feeling joyful. Isn't that sweet? They're feeling that way, and I just happen to be there, you know? Or if they say something very rude, like to take a moment, again, more peripheral than if someone's really close to me, and say, oh, wow, what is going on with their space? Because that's
right.
Really intense coming right at me. And then just to feel compassion for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
If, like I said, if it's not too close, it seems like the more one practices it peripherally, that when it does come really close to someone that you care about a lot, you might get triggered, like you can practice it, you know,
exactly.
My brain going to that response or something. So it's really kind of fun.
So yeah, and someone being really aggressive is a much more challenging situation than what we normally deal with. Normally it's the slights and the critiques and the little things and the mind reading that we do, you know, that it's a lot easier to be aware when it's not so intense. So just remember, when you're judging someone, it's really about you. And when you're being judged, it's really about them. If there's something you can learn and change that's specific about behavior, great. If not, just give it back to them in your own mind. I mean, just you don't have to take it in. Oh, this is someone putting all of their projection on me. I just want to throw out a little bumper sticker phrase that helps me. Care about others, not about what others think of you. That we can really replace a lot of our how am I doing energy and, you know, wondering if someone likes you or approves of you. You can replace that energy with, like, how can I help? Or how can I care about this person? And it can be so nice. It's just such a nice reframe to be relating to people from that place. And I know this is going to sound like sort of simple, but it was just so helpful when I heard someone interviewing the Dalai Lama who said, so you speak publicly all the time. And as the aside, this wasn't part of the interview, but public speaking is apparently the biggest fear of people. You know, we talked earlier about the most common, but the biggest fear of everybody is public speaking. And death is at like number 4 on the list. This is a time poll or something. So Jerry Seinfeld says, so let me get this straight. So that means at a funeral, you're better off being in the casket than giving the eulogy. So the guy's asking the Dalai Lama, so you're speaking in public all the time, you know, like, do you ever get nervous about it? And the Dalai Lama says, well, not, I mean, maybe sometimes, but as soon as I do, I just remember, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for others. So as soon as I change my focus to, is this helpful to others or not, the nervousness goes away. Mm-hmm. So that's a big thing in terms of relating to, you know, others' critiques of you is to change the energy from how am I doing to, you know, how can I help or how can I care or how can I connect? So the key thing when you get criticized is to get curious about the other person. If you're going into blame about yourself and what's wrong with you, that's not helpful. If you're going into blame about them, that is not helpful. What's helpful is to be curious. Curious about what is it like to be them, and curious about what is it like to be me. Both. And if the situation, if the context feels right to you, it can be very, very interesting and scary to unilaterally disarm and go vulnerable and actually name your vulnerability and name your feeling. And the example I can give is with a good friend of mine when I lived in Vermont, guy friend, we played soccer together, we did a lot of sports stuff, we did a lot of guy stuff together. And we really liked each other a lot, we had a lot in common, but we were also testy with each other. And Lisa would say to me sometimes, what's up with you and Jeff? Like, you guys seem to be argumentative. And I'm like, I know, what's going on with that? But then I realized I was scared. I was really scared of, he's can be kind of forceful and kind of critical at times. So we were having dinner together one night, and it was just a big risk, but it felt like it was a worthy risk. And I just said, I'm scared. That's all I said. And he just put his fork down and he looked at me and he said, me too. And that moment changed our friendship. Like immediately, I mean literally, like just deepened. And maybe all the women in the room are like, duh, but I don't know. This is more of a guy thing. But it, you know, it can really be cool to be adventuresome. Like, the most macho thing you can do, right, is to admit you're scared. That's really macho, because that takes a lot of courage and bravery to admit that. Being macho is not so macho. Being vulnerable is. So that's the other thing, is to if you could actually speak your experience, it changes things instantly. You know, obviously you need to do it when you feel like it's a worthy risk, that, you know, you're not in the danger zone, you're in the risk zone by going vulnerable. Okay. I'll just sort of stop with that, see if there's any more interaction. To that? So this really goes in that mind reading kind of category, and it's so hard. Maybe this is the hardest, right? In some ways, as hard as it is to get feedback, it's almost harder not to get the feedback and just to get the rejection. So I mean, this is easy to say and hard to do. Just don't know what you don't know. And that takes a lot. I mean, in some ways, that's one of the hardest aspects of the meditative path, is to be willing to not know what you don't know. And to not spend a ton of energy second-guessing yourself. If there's something constructive, you know, in terms of talking to mentors in the field, you know, who could maybe give you some insight or feedback, great. If there's some inquiry you can do that's going to actually help you learn something and change something, great. But to spin around in feeling like something's wrong with me, or I'm cursed, or I'm this, or I'm that, is voodoo. And it's just not helpful. So this is very hard to do. But the way to not know what you don't know is to sit with what you can know. And that is your experience. So you can know how you feel, and you can actually ask yourself, what's it like right now, you know, when, you know, you get a rejection and there's nobody's telling you why. And, you know, to be with that, I mean, I'm imagining that's a very complex set of reactions. That's what you can know. And getting support, especially professional support, is like really critical. But that's the tough one.
Okay. So what do you do about someone who's just your enemy?
Mm.
Someone who just hates you. Mm. You know? Seriously.
Mm.
And you don't really know why. And they're really nasty.
Oh.
Nasty people.
And you have to interact with them?
Well, they're friends of good friends, so yes. We go out and they come. And they're just really awful. I mean, really. I mean, from the get-go,
I don't know. Just do every possible thing to keep away. I mean, I don't. You know, why would you want to be around for that?
Well, I don't. It's just that they're good friends with someone that I socialize with.
So can you and the good friend have an understanding that
she knows that she
just let's really avoid anything that's going to put us together. And I mean, unless you want to, if you want to confront this head on and work with the person. Okay.
I've tried telling them.
Yeah.
But they're so awful. When I try to be really loving, I can't do it. You know, like to put out the good.
Do you, were you here last week when we did difficult person?
Yeah, but they're too
they're beyond a 4 or 5. Yes. Wow, someone listened to me. You know, I would say as a spiritual adventure to be curious and interested what it would be like for you to take this up as a practice. Only if you're interested and willing. Because as the Dalai Lama said, it's our enemies that make us stronger than even our guru can, right? So if you're willing and interested in practicing with that, again, that would be like being willing and interested to practice with physical pain on the meditation cushion, which can be great to do, but only if that interest is there. If it's a guilt trip or, you know, some grim determination, you're not going to learn much. But as a spiritual experiment for this lifetime we have, this gift of our life, what might it be like to do 10 minutes a day for that person? I don't know. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, of course. See, the point of that practice is not to not feel those difficult things. The point of the practice is everything we talked about last week, which is, can you orient to, this is just a bad fit between you and this person. They are not necessarily evil or this or that, not necessarily. Yeah. It's a really bad fit, but there must be a human beating heart in there. And it, as I said last week, if we can rehabilitate a person in our heart, we have one less enemy in the world. So that sounds like your only option, but only if you're willing and interested.